Can you imagine a preacher giving a message about the priesthood of all believers while his face is on a jumbotron?
That's exactly the thing. It's like you can't do that.
No, it doesn't matter what he says. Yeah. What he's communicating is only my voice matters.
For a season, Aaron Nyquist worked at a church called Willow Creek in the Chicago area. A church that functioned as a kind of flagship for mainline Christian practice. He also served at Mars Hill in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A church whose culture was often seen as a step away from, if not a remedy for, the culture and practice of churches like Willow Creek. In my conversation with Aaron, I found someone who was sincerely and profoundly concerned with the actual formation of actual people. His concern, as well as his expertise, stem from having been in the mix and actually invested in these various expressions of faith through multiple seasons of change. Aaron is a husband, a dad, a liturgist, and a writer. His most recent book, The Eternal Current, is the focus of our conversation and is a really helpful look at the practices that hold together and form both lives and cultures. Check it out.
Where are you calling from?
I'm actually in the San Francisco Bay Area up in Martinez, California.
How are you? Okay.
Yeah. You were out here like, I don't know, maybe a month and a half or so ago, closer to San Francisco.
Well, spring break, we were out there.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a little while ago. I was there. I was in Southern California yesterday, actually. Spent the last 4 days or something down in the Newport area. But I realized. I was speaking at a church on the Sunday.
Yeah.
And then had a day to just see some friends I never get to see, which was great. And then Tuesday did a retreat with the church and then another meeting. So it was good. It was fun.
You had stuff going on, man.
Yeah, it was busy. The church I spoke at, they do 4 services.
Oh, my.
And I almost perished. Like it was.
No, but you've done that a bit, though. I mean, like because
never speaking, though. Like I've been leading worship for like 100 years. So that I know how to kind of manage my energy for that. I'm a kind of a rookie speaker. And so I was doing the message and stuff. And so the 4 services almost killed me, but it was fun. It was really great that they, you know, people seem to get on board and whatever.
Yeah,
but
it is a different energy, right? Like you would really figure that like leading songs would be more because there's theoretically or like all appearances, there's more physicality to it. There's
different.
But maybe it is a matter of practice. Cause I watch women and men I know who like they'll do, you know, 4 or 5 services speaking and it's like, you're just talking. Why are you tired? You're just talking. Why are you tired?
Right.
But anytime I have to do it, same. Oh, yeah. It's like, it's a lot. And it's different when it's a retreat setting too. Cause I'll do 4 or 5 sessions over the course of like a day or so in a retreat setting and then feel like fine. But 4 or 5 sermons.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's a different animal.
It's a different animal.
And especially, you know, I've visited the church one time. So I've never, you know, I don't know the church. I don't know the people. So it's all new and you're trying to build a bridge and connect with a bunch of strangers. And I mean, you know, all that stuff. So
this is, but so being brought in to talk and storytell and teach is relatively new for you. And like how new, like, is that in the last year? Is that since the book? Cause you've done some of that. It's not like entirely.
Yeah,
new.
No. It's, I think it was entirely new about 5 years ago when we started the practice. Like at that point I was only leading worship from behind a piano. So it was just like, all right, so not hiding behind a piano. What do I, you know, like the Will Ferrell thing. What do I do with my hands?
It's very true. It's actually very true.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, but that was last 4 years was just really helpful just in that different way. But now the going out is mostly post book. But I they gave me 35 minutes and I'm like, well, no one needs a 35 minute lecture. So I did 20 minutes of talking and then we did a 15 minute practice that we did together. So we did the examine and just, I walked them through all that.
You just said, let's kick it off there. You just said no one needs a 35 minute lecture.
Oh gosh, no.
yet that's what happened. 35 minutes is not even really that.
That might even.
I don't know if that's medium. I don't actually know what the average is. Yeah. I'm going to guess, though, the average sermon is probably longer than that.
I would say 45, probably.
Right, because I know a lot of folks who regularly teach like closer to 60 plus minutes.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
But you just said, and I love this, you just said no one needs a 35-minute lecture.
Nobody.
So,
yes. But I mean, maybe if you're in your master's study course and you know.
Yeah, but no, you're talking about like with regards to religious practice, someone who's trying to like figure out God, Jesus, faith.
Yep.
No one needs a weekly lecture of 35 minutes.
Nobody. Yes.
Nobody.
Nobody.
That's a pretty sweeping. That's a pretty sweeping term. To nobody.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's actually what you're up against, and those are the spaces you're being invited into.
Yeah.
So what do you do with the fact that it seems like every the way I do it and
I love it.
Is like, well, I'd rather just talk, because then if it's like we have this break and we're like, hey, I'd like to welcome to the show,
sure,
Mr.
Yeah,
Eddie.
No, I love
like,
it.
No, like just, we're just going to talk. So, but, yeah. So because so it's 35 minute sermon, no one needs a 35 minute lecture. So good.
Yeah.
But that is the world though. I mean, that is the, like, well, that is the format. That's how we do things. Talk about
totally.
That.
Well, what's interesting is it depends who we is. And one of the things that's been, for me over the last few years is trying to get out of, my circles. You know, I grew up in squarely kind of white evangelical circles, mm-hmm. which are great. There are so many gifts that, we have to offer the world, but getting outside of those circles, you realize not everybody does a 45 minute lecture. And in fact, most Christian traditions don't see the lecture as the high point at all. They see the table as the high point.
You're talking about like historical, cultural,
when you
broaden your lens of what it looks like for people to engage in the practice of faith.
Yeah.
It's almost as if like we have a tendency to filter our understanding of the world through our own personal experience and believe that this is everybody.
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you visit, whether it's an Episcopal church or a Catholic church, or, you know, there's the homily that is really important, but it's not the center of the center. It's not why we came to church. You know, in the churches I grew up at, you know, what's happening next Sunday at church? Oh, such and such is talking about such and such.
Right, right, right.
You know, so-and-so is talking about such and such. And, you know, in so many of our other Christian brothers and sisters, we say, what's happening in church next week? They'd say, the Eucharist. We're meeting
the same
Christ
thing that happened last week and the week before.
Yeah, right, right. And there's some real beauty in that. So.
One of the ways you actually launched the book is your book actually has a few starting places, if I think it might be fair to say, where there's sort of an introductory, kind of philosophical introductory statement.
Sure.
And then there's a little bit of kind of your story.
Yeah.
And then there's sort of like the backstory behind your story, like before you actually get into like, here's the thing I'm coming to.
Yeah.
You have a few different setups. And during one of those setups, the statement you make, which is kind of it parallels the first part of our conversation here, is you say, the more I retell these stories, this is after you've shared a little bit about your personal history as a church person.
Yep.
The more I retell these stories, the more I realize that I keep making the same point. And here's the line: my faith tradition is good, but it's not enough. And here's what I'd love to do is I want you to parse this a little bit when you talk about my faith tradition is good, but it's not enough. And then I want to talk about progression. And there's another statement you make that I'm going to get to in a second. But what do you mean when you say my faith tradition is good, but not enough? How is a thing shouldn't a thing be sufficient? Like, isn't that part of the point? Isn't that part of what we're trying to do, is to set something up for us that is enough?
Yes.
As a cultural good? Which, for better or for worse, let me ask the question better.
Yeah.
Isn't part of the goal, like, if I'm part of, like, a church plant team, isn't part of what I'm trying to do, for better or for worse, and maybe this is the mistake we make, right, is I'm trying to do something that fully, completely matches, meets people where they are in this cultural moment. You seem to be saying that, like, that's not a something you're going to get to. So can you parse, like, my faith tradition is good, but not enough? How is it both things?
Absolutely. Well, this is, I feel so, I'm going to be talking out of both sides of my mouth the whole time, because I feel such tension with this whole conversation, but I think it's really good tension. I think we get in trouble when we eliminate it and just choose this or choose that.
Right.
So maybe my first response to shouldn't it be enough would be, and I'm not trying to get in trouble with this, but, like, is second grade enough?
Hmm.
Well, when you're eight, yeah, of course it is.
Yeah.
Second grade is everything. It is perfect. It is the biggest gift. I have a first grader right now. The biggest gift I can give my first grader Mac next year is second grade. And so the problem is if you think second grade is the whole story. And so I think one way to talk about this is, in the same way that every person is part of the body, they're not the whole body, but we all are a part of the body. I think every church tradition has a part of the story that they hold and that they honor and they lift up. I haven't yet met the tradition that is the everything. And I wonder if that doesn't exist. I wonder if that's more hubris than aspiration, you know?
Which you get to this in a different way than when you talk. Yeah. There's the old Jainist philosophical image of the blind men and the elephant.
Yeah, of course. Yep.
Like, if you don't mind, let's jump to that real quick. And we talk about, like, if every tradition has kind of a part of the story, that's some of what you're getting with the elephant story. Can you retell the elephant story and then maybe posit this in that?
Yeah. I mean, the elephant story is really famous. Everybody's heard a version of it. Yeah. And it's usually told in an interfaith context.
Yep.
Which I think it has a lot of wisdom there too. But in this way, I really meant it in a ecumenical. So in a Christian context, say you get a number of people who are trying to align their lives with Christ. So that's the context I was telling it in. It's basically just, there's this elephant in a village and a number of blind men are touching different parts of it. And one's like, oh, an elephant feels like a rope. And one's like, oh, an elephant feels like, you know, feeling the tusk. And so at the end, the obvious truth is, well, you're all correct, but you're all, you just feel a part of the elephant.
Yeah.
And so
you're correct in context, and you're correct in the context of other people's understanding.
That's exactly right.
Of course.
And, you know, obviously this can, you know, there are, I have some more conservative friends that get really afraid of the slippery slope and all that kind of stuff. And I think maybe some of that fear is appropriate and a lot of that fear is not appropriate. I think we have God, the mystery of God is so much bigger than any one of our small tradition containers can hold. So it's a gift. Which for me, this whole thing is less about philosophy and more about experience.
Yeah.
Like when I say my tradition is good, but not enough, it's because I've been meeting people outside of my tradition and I'm realizing, wait a second, tell me more about that. You see God in that way? You're able to align part of your life with God in that. Tell me more, you know? So it's been a really kind of tactile journey, not just philosophical.
Now the analogy you provided before, because that's the one in the book that has to do with, again, the elephant and which is more of like a static reality. Like here's an understanding of what is. The other one that you just got to, which I think for me is a little bit more intriguing, has to do with progression, has to do with growth and change. That this is something that is good, and a way in which it's good but not enough is that it's good for now. And because it's good for now doesn't necessarily mean it's good for later. you talk about progression.
Absolutely.
And
yes.
Do you have a sense of like a historical cultural progression with regards to the institutional cultural practice of faith? And like, is there a broad kind of long progression? Is there, or is it mostly just a personal progression? Like, what do you see?
Oh man, what a sweeping, amazing question. I think I've been feeling so much trying to just stay a Christian as an individual.
Right.
When I get into the bigger, what's going on, I mean, right now, American yes. Christianity, no, white evangelical American
That's
Christianity.
It.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
I mean, it's just like when I go there, I just despair. I want to jump
Which is part of where the question
thing.
Comes from, obviously, and it's part of what makes this conversation key now, specifically with yeah. regards to progress, is it because what a lot of folks are asking and should ask is like, well,
yeah.
is it possible that not just in philosophy and knowledge, but in practice, that what we have done, what we've set up, like had its time and needs to be done? And that,
yeah.
so like, is there a cultural progression in which here's the way we used to do things?
Right.
And if we're going to continue to grow, we can no longer, should no longer do things this way. Do
yeah.
you see that? Or is it more of like, no, there will always be room for this type of thing where there will always, because, you know, the 35-minute lecture,
the four
songs and a hymn.
Yeah.
Like, is there a point at which historically, culturally, like you have to put something down and move away? Or does it just
yeah.
expand and grow and there's always room for that?
Yeah, it's a great question. A lot of my friends are going back, becoming Anglicans. I have friends becoming, you know, grew up in kind of low, like rock and roll church, and now they're becoming priests and kind of going in that direction. And I really respect that, and I get why they're doing it. But I personally don't feel like the way forward is backward. I feel the way forward is going back to our roots and learning all the things that our elders, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, have taught us, but then going forward. You know, it's why I was talking in that final chapter, the kind of benediction,
yeah.
about people of memory
yes.
and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like, you know, my parents' generation, kind of who started the mega church thing, they felt like their parents' church was dead and didn't matter, irrelevant. So they pretty much pitched everything.
Yes.
And just did kind of crazy make-em-up church.
Right.
Well, that was a huge gift to the world. But now our generation is looking at it like, it's just so thin. There's nothing to it. You
right.
know, it's exciting. It's loud. But what about where are the roots?
Right.
And so I think a lot of us are trying to say, we need to go back and capture some of the roots of our grandparents as we build a brand new thing for the future.
And I think you actually reference Walter Brueggemann's prophetic imagination in the book.
Yes.
And part
yes.
of what Brueggemann does with his reference to the prophetic tradition is that the role of the prophetic is never
yeah.
really so that you would understand the past for the sake of understanding the past.
Yeah.
But the role of like the prophetic tradition is that you would understand your past through a prophetic lens so that you can live more faithfully into your next step.
That's absolutely. And what's so compelling about Brueggemann is he's an Old Testament scholar.
Right. Because he's always looking backwards.
He's always immersed in the depths of the history, but for the sake of the future. And I think it's that both that is so compelling. Yeah. So to your question, I mean, you know, I look right now at our tradition and, you know, the tradition I grew up in, and it's so tempting to just pitch it all because it's so sick and it's so toxic right now. And I don't mean just like the brand is toxic. No, no, no. It is actually creating human beings that are worse for the world.
Yes.
So, but then I have to say, is it every part of it? you know, like when my, I have a spiritual director who's a Jesuit priest, and when he comes to teach and worship with our little community on Sunday nights, he gives me an earful about all the things that he loves about it. He's like, your people actually sing? He's like, when I lead mass, nobody sings. They don't care. They're barely.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And so he reminds me about the parts of my tradition that are really, really good. While he's also teaching me ways to, you know, clearly try to get out of the constraints and the toxicity of it. So I really think there's not a simple answer about either double down on it or pitch it all. I think there is a, yes, there is cancer in this body. Do we put it down? Or do we do chemo? Or do we, you know, I truly don't know what that is.
Yeah.
While I'm rambling.
No, you're not at all. This is good.
Okay. I feel zero, just personally. Some people may feel called to this. I feel zero desire to try to save evangelicalism. You know, to try to like, how do we rehabilitate? It's just a container that people built, like any, right. like any tradition.
Yes.
What I can't get past though, is there are literally millions of sincere evangelicals who know they can't stay in this thing, but don't know where to go. And that's where I get really passionate. I'm not trying to save the system, let the system go. But a lot of the people, it's not all Franklin Graham. I mean, you know, evangelicals who are every bit as sincere Christ people as anyone else, but man, they're a part of a system that is kind of ending.
Which comes to this great tension, the part of the way you communicate this tension, again, you talk about progress, you talk about steps, and this whole, it's a little bit of a philosophical understanding of the way progress works and the way growth works, that there's, that you don't get step one and then you have step four, and that part of what makes, part of what makes step four work is that you took steps, is that you took steps two and three as well.
Absolutely.
And so the way you write about this, I'm going to read this backwards. And I'm going to read this and then ask you to expand and vamp on a little bit. Where you say, some people, when they realize how small and tribal their view of God has been, decide to swing the pendulum the other way and reject the intimacy of songs and ideas such as Jesus Loves Me. This comes at great and unnecessary cost. The part of what you're getting here is when we start to recognize that something is not okay or that something is broken, the tendency is to then ditch everything that had to do with that moment, which you say more broadly when you talk about these steps, and you say, we want to move from step three to step four on a journey. We often assume it requires a complete rejection of step three in order to move forward. The stage that is most difficult to value is often the stage we just left. But step four isn't a rejection of step three. Difficult critiques of progressivism in any form. And I consider myself a progressive. I'm a left-leaning progressive. Like anyone who's around me knows it.
Sure.
But one of the harshest critiques I have of my own tradition as a progressive is our capacity, our tendency, almost our need to take a next step and then turn around and look at the place we just were and light it on fire.
Burn it to the ground.
This is all bad because I'm here.
Yep.
Can you talk about what does it look like as someone who is looking at it has been part of, because it's not for you personally.
Yeah.
It's not like you've just been an evangelical. You've been at, you were at Mars Hill, which set a tone for what evangelicalism looked like after Willow. You were also at Willow. Yeah. It set the tone for the thing that Mars Hill was trying to correct.
That's right.
Yep. You've been in both places in terms of progression, and you're in this new place. How do you not turn around and want to light things on fire? What's it look like to be someone who's willing to progress, yeah. but also honor your past, et cetera. Like, talk about that in your personal
life. Oh, man, that is so good. Well, maybe I'll start here with one of my wife's quotes. You can take the boy out of fundamentalism, but you can't always take the fundamentalism out of the boy.
Interesting. Okay,
and good. It is, you know, I grew up in a we are right and everyone's wrong conservative circles. We had all the truth and no one else had any of the truth. Well, I have had seasons as I've moved kind of to the other side, realizing how small that is, where, again, I was right and everyone was wrong. I was just coming from a different vantage point now.
Right.
So it wasn't actually a growing. It wasn't an expanding. Mm. It was just a shifting of my fundamentalism. And we've probably all experienced that, you know, the fundamentalist left can be just as nasty as the fundamentalist right, even if the ideas are better. But anyways, so I think I talk about in the book in the include and transcend idea. And I learned that from Ken Wilber. Have you read much Ken Wilber?
No.
He wrote A Theory of Everything. And he is he started the Integral Institute, and sure. I think he's a Buddhist by practice, and he's a philosopher. He's brilliant. I mean, I read every page of his book. There's one sentence I can understand, but it's like the smartest thing I read all day. You know,
yeah.
But he talks so much about this include and transcend idea, that it's not step one, leave it. Move on to step two, but it's step one plus step two plus right. step three plus this bigger space. And that has been really, really challenging. And yet, you know, you look at what either or us and then us against them is doing to the world right now.
Yeah.
And it's catastrophic.
It is catastrophic. And even more so when it would suggest what you get to really well and really softly in the book is it ends up being more so catastrophic when it is us against who I used to be, when it's me against who I used to be.
Yes.
And that I can't I want to be me now. And I have a past, cultural past, sociological past, and I need to hate myself in order to be myself.
Yeah.
How destructive that is.
And
in the tension of, and I love this line from the book, so there are a few things more crushing to kids than to feel crushing. Here's the line. There are a few things more crushing to kids than to feel that the purpose of their lives is to merely protect someone else's legacy.
Yeah.
That in order to, like, what I want to be able to let go of is that there were things that I was a part of that I didn't build.
Yep.
But that those things were also good for me so that I could build the thing that is coming next.
Yes. Yes. And it really is where this whole conversation invites us to an entirely different way of interacting with reality. I mean, it really, if we're going to move into this space where, as Richard Rohr says, everything belongs,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it just requires let me be religious. It requires being born again.
Hmm.
And it's not easy, and it's painful, and you only need to be born again if you first died. I mean, you know, like, new life only comes after death. And so this Paschal mystery, this rhythm of life, death, rebirth, life, death, rebirth. And when we're in the season of death and loss, I mean, we really can double down on our anger, on the villains who cause this pain on us. We can spend the rest of our life trying to export and punish the people who screwed us.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can let the pain, and again, this is so easy to talk about on a podcast, right? But frankly, I'm coming off one of the most painful years of my life. Mm-hmm. So I'm not doing it well, but I'm not talking about pain from a distance.
No.
We can either, let it launch us into what's Princess Bride, Inigo Montoya, where a life of vengeance, or we can let it help us die so that we can be reborn into a new way.
Part of the tradition, the white Western evangelical tradition.
Yeah.
Actually, I'll get to it this way, because when we talk about things that do need to die and things to let go, because you talk about inclusion, you talk about there was the phrase you just used, and it's the Ken Wilber.
Yeah.
It's not inclusion. It is inclusion.
Yeah.
It's transcend and include. What was the phrase?
Include and transcend.
So when you talk about including and transcending, there are things though that you don't want to include necessarily.
Absolutely. Yes.
Some things need to go away.
Yes.
And really specifically, a thing that seems clear to me, and it seems you get to in the book, lightly. Which is good. The Western evangelical, the white Western evangelical marriage to right-wing republicanism.
Yes. Yes.
Needs to go away.
Yes.
As a rule. Not that you can't be, not. I'm not at all saying like, well, now we need to all be Democrats.
Although that's what people hear when
I say that. What I mean is the gateway that folks walk through into Western evangelical Christianity, if you're white, is you also walk through the door of republicanism, and that it blinds us to all kinds of things so that we, you know, at 80, whatever percent vote. Trump into the White House. You don't avoid saying at least to some degree that this is not a thing we want to include going forward, but the thing you don't say, which I'm really glad you don't say, is like, well, that means becoming apolitical. That in order to actually not do this, then we need to divorce ourselves from politics.
Yes.
The way you write it, you say, if the church is not political, it is irrelevant to the world that God so loves. But if the church is partisan, it becomes a tool of the power structures. Can you vamp on that for a minute?
Oh, absolutely. I think that section starts, or at least it started in me, with the, we cannot pretend we love our neighbors if we ignore the policies that hurt them.
Yes.
And that's where for me, like, I just have to name my privileged reality, which is I live in a little suburb in, you know, a middle-class suburb, and a lot of these conversations, they offend my soul, but they don't affect me.
Interesting.
I'm not worried about losing my immigration status. I'm not. So we have the luxury, middle-class white people, of saying, well, you know, that we should maybe get involved with that, but let's just stay on what really matters, the spiritual. Mm. Well, tell that to the person who still hasn't got their kid back.
Right. And then tell them also that that's not a spiritual question.
And tell them it's not a spiritual.
That being separated from your family because of American backwards foreign policy isn't a matter of religion and spirituality.
It's bonkers. And so what I think is really tough, and this is, you know, not in the book, just so you know, I really struggled with what is appropriate content for a book versus what is appropriate for a podcast, what is appropriate for, you know, blogs, if those still exist. And so I didn't go into some of the weeds with this stuff in the book, but I mean, some of why we're in this problem, in my opinion, is because white evangelical pastors have tried to be apolitical.
Yeah.
And so we have,
as opposed to being rightly political,
correctly
or righteously political.
Yeah, righteously, good word. And so, like, the fact that we could allow people who are deepening in their walk with Christ also hold on a deep distrust for Muslims is bonkers. Yeah. It's malforming disciples. And but we have these little pockets where you're not allowed to be gay, but you are allowed to be any of these other, you know, things that Jesus talks so clearly about.
Hateful, bigoted, in massive debt.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Jesus made fun of the idea that rich people would enter into the kingdom of heaven. Like, like a camel going through an eye. Like, Jesus made fun of that idea.
Right.
And in my whole life, I still never heard a sermon about that. Because they don't want to offend the tithers, you know. We need them around. Yeah. But so how do we engage? While we're talking about this, can I give one other thought?
Yeah, go.
And it sounds like this will not be certainly offensive to you or your audience. But, you know, when Trump got elected, the 81% number was just just staggering. And I'm embarrassed to admit, I'm the classic suburban white guy who was clueless how widespread this was. Mm-hmm. And so at first it was, well, you know, there's multiple reasons. I didn't want to go, just one naive explanation, you know, well, there, you know, there's economic things, there's Roe versus Wade, there's all this kind of stuff. A year and a half in, you know what I think? It's race.
It is race.
It is race.
It is.
And what I hear from people I know who voted for Trump, some of whom I love dearly, what I hear them saying in every conversation is they have got too much of ours, and Trump's going to take it back.
That's great.
That's the whole thing. Yeah. And you know what color they are? And you know what color us is?
Yeah.
And as that has become, again, I'm so slow to it. All my friends of color are like, really, Aaron? Really? This is your great revelation?
Here you are now.
I know. I've been so slow to come to this. But it is race.
Yeah.
And fear based on race. And Trump is, I mean, he's an idiot in so many ways. He is brilliant in the exploiting of the fear of the other.
And you get to this when you talk about, you make a reference to Margaret Rose as someone who's been informative to you with regards to the religious practice of, because your whole thing is about practice as opposed to just head knowledge.
Yep.
Because
yep.
you can think these things.
Yeah.
And actually, I'll frame it this way. You can think that you're not a racist.
Yeah.
You can do all that math in your mind. But if it's not a thing you've practiced, if you have not practiced life with folks who are not like you, then there is every possibility in the world that you could have thought through all the mathematics, still get around the economic and social realities of black and brown people and not be able to deal with it because of your core, you are not practiced at living with others. And so you get into these principles of hers that you're practicing your own life.
Yeah.
And at the core of it is this philosophical notion. You say that engaging the other with grace helps us become more secure in our own identities, which is counterintuitive to, and this is my vamp on this, which is counterintuitive to the white evangelical practice previously, which was that in order to maintain my identity, I need to defend myself from the other.
That's exactly
so
right.
If we have LGBTQ folks around, we can't live in disagreement because what we're concerned with is that somehow these ideologies, these practices, these ways of life, these people would infect us. So we can't really do that because we might lose who we are. What she says, what you're adopting is like, no. In order for you to actually understand who you are, you have to engage with folks you don't understand, you don't recognize, and you don't even necessarily like.
Yes. Oh, it's so good. Absolutely. And, you know, even as you were saying that, I was just thinking, you know, from a religious standpoint, so many of us in our like souls or in our bones are still operating under a more, you know, Hebrew scriptures view of clean and unclean, and you can't touch this, and you have to protect yourself from you know, just that, yeah, don't get soiled by what is deemed ritually unclean. When Jesus did not share that same perspective, I mean, was just relentlessly mixing up everything. And it, you know, drove the religious gatekeepers crazy. But even though we talk about Jesus and the new covenant and, you know, the dividing wall has been set down, we've so spiritualized all that. And we still kind of live our lives in the other perspective. Could I share one of the practices that we did as a community along these lines?
That's actually what I was going to ask you to do. Is
oh, good.
Like you talk about, and if this is the one you're going for, I'd like you to tell both stories, and then we'll wrap it up with the thing that we do on the podcast every time.
Oh, great.
I'd love for you to talk about this practice specifically. What does it look like to practice life in the direction of in a posture towards the other?
Yeah.
You tell one story in the book about a practice you implemented right after the election.
Yes. And that was the one I was going to mention.
Yeah. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that. And part of the way you set it up is we decided to embrace two of the church's callings. This is directly from the book. We decided to embrace two of the church's callings to be priests and to be prophets, not either or, but both. And which is part of what you do with this practice you implemented right after the election. Talk about what it looked like for you guys to lean into being priests and prophets shortly after the 2016 election.
Well, yeah. Well, let me say, I'll do the after the election one, but I think that was only possible because of our pre-election one. So I'll talk about that next. But the after the election one, literally the Sunday after the election, we had planned that we were studying the Beatitude, Blessed Are the Peacemakers. So it was just like, are you kidding me? That's what we're okay. Here we go. And so we invited, a woman from our community, a fiery Latina woman who is just, she is awesome, to write a prophetic prayer for Donald Trump and this new administration. And then we invited my spiritual director, a Jesuit priest, to write a priestly prayer. And honoring both of those traditions. And so, you know, the priestly prayer was, you know, that God would give him wisdom and grace and guidance and some of those things. And then the prophetic prayer that God would help him repent of the language that divides us, that demeans, that, I mean, I've never experienced anything like that, but we held them both together because it's both.
Yeah.
And so that was the practice on that Sunday after the election. But the thing I think that got us ready for that is about 6 months before the election, as the just Trump and Hillary stuff was spiraling into such venom and ugliness. And then we just said, again, we're going to blow the world up, and we can't change Washington, but we can begin to change ourselves. And so we said, you know, information doesn't change us, but practices do. So what is the thing we can do over and over that will form us into the kinds of people where we even could engage the other with grace? And this is why sometimes like these mission trips are disastrous. Because people who are formed for something else are now placed side by side with people that they've been taught to hate their whole life, and it's not helpful. So, so what we said is, you know, every Sunday for 3 years up to that point, we'd been always doing a confession of our own sin, silence, and then an assurance that we've already been forgiven as far as the East is from the West. And that's just something we learned from most of the other kind of mainline Christian traditions. And so we've been doing that, and it's been really helpful. And we said, you know what? We're going to add a third movement every Sunday. So we're going to confess our sins, sit in silence. We're going to hear a reminder of grace, and then we're going to pray for one of our enemies. And so I started, you know, just by obviously Jesus is not unclear about how we are to treat our enemies. So I said, all of us would raise our hands and say, we believe this is factually true.
Yeah.
but none of us do it. Yes. And there was no one disagreed. Yeah. None of us pray for enemies. So we said every Sunday we're going to do it. So sometimes there'd be a prompt, you know, like, let's pray for, you know, at that time Syria was blowing up and trying to figure out how to pray for Assad and that whole thing. Sometimes it would get really personal. You know, I just say, someone in your life has become like an enemy. And so we're going to put Jesus' words into practice. And I want you to pray to bless them. And so don't like pray that God would change them or punish them. Change that God would bless them. And so we do that. And then one Sunday, we actually put up on the screen Trump's face and Hillary's face. And that was very uncomfortable, obviously. And I just said, all right, now we're going to invite you to pray for one of them, but don't pray for the one you're for. Pray for the other one.
Yeah.
Look in their eye. And then just gave some prompts like, pray for their spouse. Pray for their kids. Can you imagine being one of their children right now? And just, you know, and it was uncomfortable and we all kind of hated it. None of us wanted to do this, but it's the way of Jesus.
Yes.
And so we just thought, if we do this 52 times this year, who are we going to be? Who are we going to become if we put this kind of thing into practice? So anyways, just one example of
that's good.
A small thing we can do over and over and over that forms us. You know, the opposite is listening to talk radio. And that's a small thing that forms us every day to hate the other.
Yeah. I really appreciate that you are doing with the book I just finished. Actually, I had a great conversation with Jonathan Merritt. Who does this with some culturally spiritual words as well.
Yep.
One of the things we do with the podcast is the way we use words actually forms definition. Like, in other words, the way we understand a word is really actually shaped by the way it's used.
Right.
And so this practice of lexicon that we'll do with the podcast, the way you think about the words I'm going to give you, the words on this list, you know, you'll talk about the word liturgy later on.
Yeah.
Or worship, et cetera. It's not a dictionary definition in terms of like, this is what it is, and now I have to live up to this particular definition. Like, you've practiced these things, and part of what you're doing with the people around you is like, there are these head knowledge understandings you have of God, of people, of other, that you can only practice your way in out of. You can, otherwise you're stuck there. You can practice your way out of this.
Yep.
You can't think your way out of that.
Yep. Yep.
And so what I'd love to do is take some of the words that actually they show up either in periphery or directly in your book and in your work, and have you vamp for 30, 45 seconds. It can be like a redefinition. It can be a quick story. It can just be like whatever comes up in you. Yeah. There's no right answer here. But I'm going to put some words on the table and have you just talk about that word so that listeners can hear, like, this is the shape that word takes. Yeah. In Aaron's life.
Okay. That's cool.
Spiritual. What is spiritual?
Well, I mean, I obviously think of my friend Rob's phrase, everything is spiritual. The idea that there is more than just what we can touch with our fingers. There is a mystery behind, beneath, inside, beyond. That's what I think of.
That's good. You've led songs and you've taught and you've been part of services, and this word gets just bandied about so much that it's a word that means a lot to me.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's a word that I really do, and I don't fear this about many words, I really do wonder if this word has maybe just been stepped on and kicked around enough that I'm not sure we'll ever really get an actual, like, not an even agreed upon meeting, but like, can this ever really be functional again? I have hope.
Yeah. Okay.
Worship.
Yeah.
What the hell is worship, Aaron? What the hell are we talking about anymore? What is this thing?
Well, you know that whole thing where, like, if I were to hold up a cotton swab, one of those little things, and said, "What is this?" People would say that's a Q-tip.
Right.
But I'd say, no. Q-tip is one brand of it. There's also, you know, this is actually a cotton swab. It's that same thing with tissue that we call Kleenex and whatever.
Right.
I really think that's what we've done with worship and singing. So, hey, everybody, we're going to worship now. What do you assume we're going to do? We're going to stand and sing pop songs, you know? And so I think it has been shrunk down to that to such a profound degree. My job as worship leader is song leader.
Yeah.
Well, singing is one great way to worship God, but it doesn't even get close to Romans 12:1, offering our bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pure. And so, yeah, to be honest, I'm trying to avoid the word worship a little bit these days.
Right.
Because it is so profoundly unhelpful. And what is worship? It's singing. What is good worship? It's the singing that makes me feel warm about God.
Right.
Well, again, there's nothing wrong with that. That's all good stuff. But I don't think it's anywhere near what we're invited to give ourselves to. So I think I just gave the anti definition of worship.
But what you're communicating is, I mean, that's the struggle we're that's not the struggle we're in. I mean, that's the conundrum we're in. It's the thing we fight against all the time, which is the thing we've practiced ourselves.
Yes,
into.
That's exactly right. Yeah,
we've practiced ourselves. No one,
no
one came
loud.
Exactly.
We just
no,
did it
we don't
every
teach
Sunday.
Like here's what worship is.
Exactly.
In fact, we'll say, and Jamie Smith does this in his book Imagining the Kingdom. He's like, you can say whatever you want to say from up front, but the format of your gathering has educated your people to understand what this life is in a way that your words will never, ever in a million years combat. You have to practice your way out of it.
It's absolutely right. Can you imagine a preacher giving a message about the priesthood of all believers while his face is on a jumbotron?
That's exactly the thing. It's like, you can't do that from here.
It doesn't matter what he says. Yeah. What he's communicating is only my voice matters. So anyways.
Talk about liturgy. One of this podcast guests, David Dark. I don't know if you're familiar with Dave Dark.
I don't know personally, but I really respect his perspective on things.
And part of what he does with the word liturgy, again, as a practice, because he uses it as regularly as he does on Twitter and in podcasts and in books, is he's working to reorient his audience's understanding of the word liturgy. You have a particular context for the word liturgy with regards to practice. So I'd love for you to talk for a few minutes and we'll land here on what does liturgy mean for you?
That's great. This, opposed to the word worship, I think this word is equally misunderstood, maybe more, but I think this one needs to be recaptured. Mm. So I actually have a lot of energy for this word. And I don't mean it as widely as David Dark means it, which I think it's so compelling how he talks about it.
Yeah.
But for me, liturgy is, I mean, literally means the work of the people. It's what we do when we come together. So like a church I was a part of a number of years ago, our liturgy was loud song, medium song, earnest song, announcements, offering, sermon, doubly earnest song. That was our liturgy. And it's fine. It does exactly what it's trying to do. So the question is not, do we have a liturgy or are we a liturgical church? The question is, how does our current liturgy form us? Does it form us into more consumeristic people? Does it form us into more tribal people? Does it, you know, all those kinds of questions. So I love the word liturgy and I'm being more careful in how I use it. I think for a while I would just drop it into, okay, now our liturgy is going to be, and then a lot of people's guards would come up for understandable reason. They've been taught it was one specific kind of oppressive thing. But for me, it's the plan of what we do. I mean, when we go to the gym, if you don't have some sort of liturgy, you're just going to stumble around and like, well, I'll do a couple bench presses here. Okay, well, maybe I'll run a mile, you know. that's not going to form your body the way that you're at the gym to be formed. So I think well thought through liturgy that is both connected to the wisdom of people who have done this, but also open to the realities that my body is different from anybody else's. My soul is different from anybody else's. We live in a world that's never existed. So here we go. That's
good.
Yeah, I have a lot of energy for that word and for the idea. Because I think when some of our traditions threw everything that felt liturgical or old or out, we just lost so much wisdom. And then it's just kind of the blind leading the blind. Well, what do you want to talk about today? You know?
Yeah.
And I think there's a better way.
Aaron, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. And thank you for listening to this episode of the At CE Podcast. You can follow up with Aaron Nyquist by visiting his website, which is Aaron Nyquist, and that's N-I-E-Q-U-I-S-T. Two A's, Aaron, and then Nyquist, N-I-E-Q-U-I-S-T.com. From there, you can bounce over to A New Liturgy, which is where you'll find a lot of the work he does around music and formation and prayer. It's actually fantastic, specifically for this season when this episode is dropping, which we call Lent. You can find me at justinmcroberts.com, and if you are interested, which I would invite you to be, in supporting the work of this podcast, head over to patreon.com, patreon.com, and search my name, Justin McRoberts. We'd love to have you on the team. Until next time.